Get ready to rumble. Shilling Show Unleashed on the Seven Thunders Media Network. Former city councilor, husband, father, and community watchdog. Your host, Rob Shilling.
Welcome to the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast. Remember, your direct support makes our show possible, and you can directly support this podcast by visiting shillingshow.com and then clicking on the Patreon banner at the top of the page to make a monthly contribution. We appreciate your support. The Shilling Show Unleashed podcast welcomes David Lee Gates, PhD, a climatologist and professor emeritus at the University of Delaware, also with the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, and is the co-editor of the new book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. David Lee Gates, thank you for joining us today on the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast.
Thank you for having me.
To get to the title of the book, would you tell us how we have thus far avoided realism in these fields?
Well, that's part of the issue, is that if you follow climate change at all, you know that what winds up happening is we get a discussion that says that climate is an existential threat, that humans are making changes to the climate. And in particular, what's happening is that we are destroying our environment. When you actually start to look at the science and you start to look at the policies that are supposed to fix this, they aren't going to fix it. There is no real strong science that says we're destroying the planet. Our planet is not becoming more inhabitable over time. And that's what I said, that all the scenario that's demonstrated to you is essentially a scenario that is false. The realistic scenario is that things are generally getting better. More carbon dioxide is better. Warmer temperatures are better. And there are things we need to pay close attention to be good stewards of our environment. But in particular, the climate of our planet is not on a trajectory that we're all going to die soon.
I've heard many people refer to the climate alarmists almost as a cult or with a cult-like tendency. Do you see it that way, and what's behind that?
Yeah, I think it's a religion. I think originally it started off with the idea that how do you make global socialism work? I mean, you can take a country, you can force the people to do things. How do you force the countries of the world to essentially pool their money together into a central government? And that way is effectively, you've got to shame the developed world to say, you're doing something bad, you need to fix it. And to fix it, you need to give money to a general fund that we can use for wealth redistribution. And that's what this winds up being, is a way in which the developed nations of the world are forced to pay money into a fund and therefore develop procedures and economic activities that lead you towards a global socialist type of environment.
Is this, in essence, a first world pursuit? In other words, are there people who are starving in various parts of the world who don't have enough basics who are worried about this as well? Or are we just looking at this because we've got too much time on our hands?
I think we're worried more about it with too much time on our hands. If you go back to, say, the early 1800s, the estimate was about 89% of the population was below the poverty level. Nowadays, it's about 9%. And what has gotten us there has been a technological development, the ability to farm more, to transport more, and that's on the back of inexpensive energy. And the way we got inexpensive energy was fossil fuels. So effectively, the ability of having inexpensive energy has brought us out of poverty and into a more plentiful society for all. And unfortunately, many of these economic policies want to make energy expensive so it can only be afforded by the elite few and send us essentially back to an area where 90% of the population is in poverty.
I'd like to go to the term fossil fuels because, well, I certainly understand what it means, and I understand the common usage of it. Do we have indicators these days that maybe all of these fuels have come about in another way other than from dinosaurs that decayed?
Well, that's interesting because a good friend of mine, Willie Soon, who used to be at the Harvard, the Smithsonian lab there, he essentially was on Tucker Carlson's podcast recently and talked a lot about how much of the oil and gas that we have may come about through pressure rather than simply a long time laying down sediments laden with dinosaurs, with trees and so forth, that over time gets compressed and turned into oil and gas, that it may be done simply within the system of the Earth. I would refer you to that podcast and Dr. Willie Soon's work on that to give you a better feel for how that actually happens.
David, one of the most troubling aspects of all of this is the pursuit and attempted punishment of the so-called deniers. Do you see that as a threat?
I have seen it personally as a threat, yes. The idea is in particular that the science is settled and thou shalt not disagree with our settled science. And if you do, well, there's all sorts of bad things that happen. I mean, we talk to newly minted PhDs and say, whatever you do, don't make a statement on climate change, because that can destroy your career. You can spend 4 years as an undergraduate and 6 years in graduate school and work on a PhD, get your degree, get out. And if you make the wrong statement regarding climate change at the wrong venue, the next thing you know, you're denied tenure, your PhD has gone to pot, and you're working somewhere for peanuts when you could have been an academic, you could have been a PhD working in the field.
So that's pretty disturbing to hear, and I suppose I'm not surprised, but what is to be done about that? Are we just going to be following the path of silence and least resistance, or is there some point where people come out and make statements as you have?
That's the issue, is a lot of people, once they get to my stance, and you have tenure, you can come out and make statements. Tenure does a lot of things. There's a lot of bad things about tenure. It would allow you to stop doing work, for example, and as long as you do a minimal amount, you can't be fired. But what tenure was really designed to do was to allow scientists to think out of the box, to approach things from a standpoint that hadn't been approached before, maybe controversial as well, and to protect you from employment for that. So tenure was designed, in a sense, to allow people to question, to be skeptical, to say, wait a second, are we doing this right? Have we gotten it correct? Do we need to make changes? Maybe let's think about this in a different way. That's what it was there for. And those of us that have it, hopefully we're using it for that. I see a lot of people, you know, that will tell me, look, I've been here in the federal government for 25 years. I need about another 5 to 8 years to get retirement. I don't want to throw my retirement benefits away now. I'm not going to speak out about it because I'm afraid I'll be fired from the government. I'll lose everything I've got built up. That's not the way it should be. It should be, if you've got a concern, raise it. Let's talk about it. Let's discuss it. Science is rarely ever settled, except if it's something that's completely very, very simple. And the climate system is anything but a simply run system. Yes, we need more people to speak out. The attacks on them keep the young ones from speaking out. But a lot of times when people retire, all of a sudden, then they come out. And I would hope that, you know, they would come out earlier, how long, and so we would start to get this ball rolling to allow everybody to understand, look, this is not settled science. We really need to rethink what we've been doing for the last 30 years.
I'd like to look at the term climate change. Isn't change normal? And if so, why are we making a big deal about it?
That's exactly right. I mean, the idea is somebody says, do you believe in climate change? And I said, well, yes, I do. And they look at me funny because, well, I thought you were a climate change denier. Mm-hmm. Well, no, climate changes because climate always has changed. I don't think there has ever been a period in history of the world that climate hasn't changed. And it changes on a lot of timescales. A lot of people say, yeah, it changes, but you got to wait thousands and thousands of years for that to happen. That's not true. Climate can change basis of this year. For example, we have an El Nino event. It's a warming of the Pacific waters. Okay, that's going to give us a different scenario of weather events than we had last year. It'll be different probably next year and different the year after. So climate changes on a natural basis. We got into this problem where we defined climate by an actuarial science. Climate is the mean, the standard deviation, the maximum, the minimum of temperature, for example. And that's what defines climate. And so it's not supposed to be changing, but it is, because climate is dynamic. It's variable. And this is a very complicated fund system because it's not just simply static.
As we look at the measurement, and I want to get into the real causes of warming if it's happening, but it almost seems like the thumb is on the scale in the way that they're taking measurements. Is that an accurate portrayal?
There are some cases where, literally, for example, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, part of the Department of Commerce, let me say it outright. They make up data, and I'll give you an example. There's a station here down the road about 4 miles from where I live. Okay, I can go online right now, and I can find out the current temperature of the station, or the temperature maybe. I think it comes up about every month later. But I can find out what the temperature was in December. Problem is that station hasn't been there for almost 14 years. What happens is they estimate the temperature because what you need to do, and this gets more technical, but to do a spatial interpolation, you need the field to be constant. You need observations everywhere that you had them before. And so when these stations go down, they just simply do an estimate of what that station must be. Well, here's the problem. A lot of these stations that disappear are in remote places. They have a tendency, for example, to be at the top of mountains. Mountains, as you know, are colder than the surrounding area. You remove those stations, and then you have that estimate from stations that are at lower elevation. All of a sudden, the new station value is warmer, and boom, there's a climate change baked into the system. The other thing, too, is that most of our stations tend to be where people live. So there's a concept known as the urban heat island effect. If you go into cities, for example, and particularly if you look at Washington, D.C. is a classic example. If you look at a nightly weather broadcast where they give you a temperature map of Washington, D.C., what you'll see is Center City is warmer than the surrounding countryside. Now imagine Dulles Airport, for example. When Dulles was first built, it was way out in the hinterlands because you needed cheap land to fly these newfangled airplanes. And we realized that the newfangled airplanes also needed weather observations, and it made sense to put a station out there. So we put a station at Dulles, which is located in the middle of nowhere. And if you look at it now, it is surrounded by urban sprawl. So what's happened over time is that station has seen the surroundings grow around it. The temperature rises because of the urban effect, the building of cities, the warmth that the cities trap. And so baked into Dulles is global climate change, but also a local climate change because the surroundings have changed. Now, multiply that across the planet where a lot of stations are simply being put in urban areas, and you have a network that is measuring a number of things. One part is the fact of changing local environments where you're actually measuring the observations. And that gets baked in. That's a local climate change. But if it's happening on everywhere you're measuring it, it tends to start to look like a global climate change. And so that's one of the things we have to devinate, is to separate the temperature that's coming from local effects from the temperature that's coming from a global effect. That's what makes it very difficult to do these estimates and then come up with this magic number that is somehow the temperature of the world when we measure almost none of it.
Well, we don't have a thermostat to set, and it's ridiculous to think that we could do that. And yet it's almost simplified to that point where they think, well, if we just had a certain amount of CO2, then the temperature would be this and everything would be fine. That sounds like faulty thinking.
That's definitely faulty thinking. I mean, everybody wants to say somehow that CO2 is a magic control knob. When you crank up the CO2, the temperature goes up. You turn it down, the temperature goes down. If we just simply would keep carbon dioxide concentrations and methane, nitrous oxides, all the greenhouse gases constant, that what we could do is keep temperature constant. And we know that historically that's not what happened. In fact, it works the other way around, that generally when the planet goes into an interglacial period, the plants become more active. We all of a sudden get a more interactive biosphere. The carbon cycle cranks up and you get more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So in reality, historically, temperature drives the carbon dioxide, not the other way around.
The Shilling Show Unleashed podcast continues in a moment with our guest, David Lee Gates.
Online at shillingshow.com.
ShillingShowMedia.com is your one-stop shop for websites, audio and video production, and photography.
ShillingShowMedia.com will take your project from conception to completion.
ShillingShowMedia.com is reasonably priced and highly professional.
Need a website for your business? Visit ShillingShowMedia.com.
Need a video created or edited? Visit ShillingShowMedia.com.
Have a photography or graphic design project? Visit ShillingShowMedia.com.
ShillingShowMedia.com is your one-stop shop for websites, audio and video production, and photography.
Visit ShillingShowMedia.com. That's ShillingShowMedia.com.
Unleashed. We continue now. The book is Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. Co-editor David Lee Gates is with us today. Let's talk about the demonization of CO2 and what has propagated this myth. I mean, this is a necessary component of survival for humans on the Earth.
Oh, definitely. You know, plants do better under increasing CO2. One of the things we've seen over the past, say, 20, 30 years from satellite records is that the planet is greening, except in places where you've got deforestation, except in places where we have urbanization and desertification taking place. The rest of the planet has largely become greener, and that can be attributed to more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
So as we look at this, how do we reverse the myth, and is there official demonization at the government level of CO2, and if so, can we reverse that?
Well, there is. At the government level, there is that, and people, I think, are starting to come around. I'm much more of a pessimist. I'm not a fatalist, but I'm a pessimist, and that I see things as moving slower than maybe some other people do. And a lot of people are telling me, I think the American people are starting to get it, that this has been going on for way too long, that we constantly are told, we are almost to a tipping point. We've got just 4 years to make this decision, or otherwise we've got runaway climate change. And then 4 years, it's okay, it's going to be now 10 years. And so forth. You know, in England, they said by, I think it was 2008, there would be no such thing as snow anymore. And that's not happened. I mean, constantly they're setting dates. Constantly they're telling you that by this date, we have to have stopped things. Otherwise, it's a runaway freight train. And that never happened. And at some point, you can't keep playing the Chicken Little game. You can't keep saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling. Some point, somebody's going to say, no, it's not. And I'm hoping we're getting closer and closer to that point where the American people, the people in general around the world, are starting to say, wait a minute, this is not good science, first of all. And second of all, the economic things that you're trying to force on us to stop it are just so ridiculous that we're not going to put up with this.
Well, I'd like to talk about some of those in particular as it regards the food supply. So there's an attack on beef going on, which is very disturbing. And secondarily, there's the promotion of, quote, bug-based protein. So are these directly related to the climate alarmists?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, the idea is beef cattle produce, and just like all cattle, produce a lot of methane. Methane's a greenhouse gas. We've got to get rid of cattle. We got to get rid of other ruminants from your food system. I mean, in Delaware here, I'm living in Delaware currently, we're putting a bill in the Congress that's going to ban all new natural gas connections. Mm. You have to only use electricity. You can't use natural gas. If I were to build a house, I would have to have an electric vehicle connection in every garage, which is at an expense. If I'm building a apartment complex, I have to have an electric vehicle connection for every apartment. And if they're bigger apartments, I'd have to have two. And so we're just doing things that make things far more expensive. They never ask the question, for example, how clean is this so-called renewable energy? And one of the things that people don't understand is that wind and solar take an awful lot of rare earth minerals to run, to build the turbines, to create the solar panels. Where do we get them? Well, we get them because they're called rare earths, not because they're rare, but because they don't exist in seams. Like if you've got a coal mine or a silver mine, silver coal comes in a seam. So you get into the seam and you mine it. These are distributed all over the place. The way you do it is strip mining. You take the whole mountain apart, sort through it with toxic metals to get the materials to settle out and congeal, and then you dump the toxic materials. We don't allow that anymore in the United States because it's not environmentally friendly. But what happens is in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, they use slave labor to make it work. They use child labor to get this material. It is an environmental disaster, and it's not good social justice maneuvers. You don't want to put children into this kind of toxic situation. You don't want to use them as labor. You don't want to use slave labor. Nevertheless, that's how we get the materials that are necessary to build wind turbines and solar panels. And so we think, well, they are clean and green because they just sit there and they create energy. To get them requires an inordinate amount of energy, an inordinate amount of economic deterioration. And nobody ever thinks about that, or I should say nobody's ever told about that.
So the question is, when these proponents of the alternative energy, the solar and the wind, when this is brought to their attention, what is the response? Or do they just ignore it altogether?
Some people are surprised. When the opponents are told, of course, they don't want to hear this because they've been lulled into thinking that wind and solar are the panaceas that are going to save the planet and save us from the evil gas and oil. But I think when I've presented it, when I've seen people that learn, this is actually how this stuff comes about. You know, the mainstream media has actually produced a couple of good articles that explain where this comes from in a fairest nature. And I think when people start to see this, then they realize, wait a minute, this is not what I thought this was. We were told you just produce these things and energy comes and it's all clean and nobody's hurt. And now I find that slave labor goes into it. We're destroying the environment to get these materials and to transport them around the planet. And it's not clean and green anymore. And that's when I think people hopefully will start to wake up when that word gets out more. And hopefully our book can help do that.
One of the other problems with the solar and wind is the intermittent nature of the energy source. And so either we have to have a backup when the sun isn't shining and the wind's not blowing, or we have to start learning to live with brownouts and blackouts. Do you think that will convince people that this is probably not the path to go on?
That's exactly what I've been saying all along, is that once people realize that we're now running a large number amount of wind and solar, and surprisingly that coal plant is still sitting there idling because you don't want your energy to go off zero right now. And if we do have some brownouts, we do have blackouts, and they're because we have become overly reliant on these intermittent sources of energy, I think that's when people are going to say, wait a minute, this is not what I bargained for. I mean, we're constantly told, we'll have, by the time we get there, we'll have batteries that'll be able to store that nonsense. You'd need enough batteries to cover the entire state of Delaware to keep New York City running for about one day. We don't have that many batteries. We can't have that many batteries. And so you're just not going to be able to store lots of energy on the grid. And therefore, if you're reliant on wind and solar and these intermittent sources, when the sun stops shining, when the wind stops blowing, the electricity stops flowing.
Putting that aside and just looking at the demand for electricity, and particularly the if we went out and extrapolated going forward, how much we would need to do everything they want to do. Where's the electricity going to come from, and how much capacity do we have to meet the demands of what's being asked for?
Well, I think we need to focus more on nuclear energy. I mean, in this country, nuclear energy ran into a roadblock. We had Three Mile Island about the same time that the movie The China Syndrome came out, which, if there's a nuclear meltdown at your nuclear factory or your nuclear plant, there's going to be major disasters. But they are relatively safe, fairly speaking. Many countries in Europe run 60-70% of their energy off of nuclear. We have not built a nuclear plant, I think, since Three Mile Island, which is in the 70s. So the idea is it's come a long way. We can get a lot of energy that way. And we should look into specifically how wind and solar can be used, not necessarily to power the grid or necessarily to power your car, but to work on various places where you can take things off the grid and store it. I mean, for example, you may have a light on your house that lights up your driveway at night and then recharges in the daytime. That's where solar energy would be very useful. But to try to run the grid off of wind and solar, and exclusively wind and solar, like you say, brownouts, blackouts, once those start to happen, hopefully we don't have to wait that long. But when that does start to happen, I think a lot of people will stand up and say, I won't put up with this.
David, are there any rays of hope that you see on the horizon? Because it all seems like we're going in the wrong direction.
As I said, I'm generally a pessimist, not a fatalist, but a pessimist. But everybody I talk to, some of the writers of the chapters of the book, are really starting to tell me that things are coming around. What they're starting to hear is that people are starting to understand what's being forced upon them. I think when they start to see, and when they have started to see, some of these legislation that's being produced here, for example, in the state of Delaware, what's happening on the coast, what's happening all over our state, I think there's a lot more people here in the state that are concerned that the move towards wind and solar is not a good thing, particularly as it exists on the grid. And that waking up the sleeping giant, so to speak, the populace, is what we need to do. And if that's starting to happen, then I think that gives us lots of hope.
David, if people would like to get a copy of your new book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, or if they'd like to follow the work that you do online, would you tell us how we can do those things?
Sure. We're on the Cornwall Alliance website. That is simply cornwallalliance.org. Cornwall is Cornwall Alliance.org, all one word. You can get the book there. You can also get the book on Amazon, or, as I say, anywhere fine books are sold. It should be out, my understanding is, later this month, and hopefully people will buy it.
I hope they will. It's such important information. David Lee Gates, thank you for joining us today on the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
That concludes another edition of the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast. Visit us online at shillingshow.com, where you can directly support this podcast by clicking on the Patreon banner at the top of the page and making a monthly donation. Your support is essential for the continuation of the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast. Until next time.